It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The controversy over a proposed ordinance to restrict certain guns and accessories in the city of Pittsburgh is not calming. If anything, it's getting more heated with threats of lawsuits and impeachment. I sat down Tuesday with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto in his office. Mr. Mayor, this week, about 30 Pittsburgh residents signed a petition to impeach you in a response to your effort to ban certain firearms, such as the AR-15. Opponents say you and council members are breaking state law. So what's your response to this petition?
Well, first off, we've been down this path before with the constitutionality of an impeachment being done by citizens under the state law as is. It can only be done by the state legislature. So I take it with a grain of salt. There's no politician, I think, that wants to be a polarizing figure. People get into politics because they want everyone to love them. And true or false, but you definitely have to have a majority of people in order to be elected. However, there's some issues that are worth fighting for. So our belief is that presently the state of Pennsylvania does not give cities the tools that it needs to adequately protect its citizens and provide domestic tranquility. That there are common sense approaches that we can save lives with. Some of those involve the banning of certain types of assault weapons in urban areas. That doesn't take anyone's guns away. If you have it, you're grandfathered in, but we're going to limit the amount of those types of weapons in our city, and we will go to court in order to challenge it. In order to go to court, you have to have a law to go to court with, and that's what we're doing.
Why do you feel it's necessary to ban certain accessories, including a certain type of ammunition?
So the other issue regarding the bump stocks and the armor-piercing ammunition, the bump stocks have already been decided by alcohol, firearms, and tobacco to be illegal. So that's the Trump administration admitting that. And armor-piercing bullets should be... Really, there is no need for them. You're not going to have deer with armor on. And the only thing that they're used for is to kill people. And then the third part of it is basically around the same issue that we deal with protection from abuse orders and domestic violence, which is an ability to petition the court, a family member or a law enforcement official, if that family member would be talking about harming themselves or harming somebody else, to petition the court to temporarily take away their weapons while they seek help and get better. Again, we don't view these as highly controversial. We view them as common sense approaches that will save lives.
Do you acknowledge, though, that some people are really angry about this? They see it as a violation of state law, but even an infringement on their Second Amendment rights.
Well, the Second Amendment part has been held by the Supreme Court over and over again, that the Second Amendment, just like any other amendment or any guarantee, comes with limitations. It is not that you can have rocket-propelled grenades or bazookas or other types of weapons that have machine guns that have been banned. The question is, where is that limit in an urban environment of weapons that can kill the most people and cause the most damage, and cartridges that could allow somebody to have the ability to cause carnage in mass murder? So the Second Amendment, like I said, in Supreme Court decisions, has said that there are limits on the rights to own weapons. It's not unlimited. The state law is what we're challenging in stating that the provision that the state has passed in recent years that preempts municipal governments from being able to protect their people needs to be challenged. That there are constitutional rights that people have to being protected and to being able to provide domestic tranquility. And that is in the Constitution, and the state, we question whether or not they should have the ability to limit that to people who live in urban environments.
But do you acknowledge there is anger, whether it was at the public hearing last Thursday evening or a demonstration outside of City Hall earlier than that?
I acknowledge that there is anger, but even through the hearing that happened in City Hall, the vast majority of those opposing don't live in the city of Pittsburgh. They are not residents of the city of Pittsburgh. We are a home rule charter city that has the ability to create our own laws, and the people in this city should be able to live in a community in which they feel safe. And they don't feel safe in the community that has semi-automatic weapons easier to get than an automobile.
Have you talked with District Attorney Stephen Zappala? In his letter, he suggested that what you and members of City Council are in the process of doing is illegal. You have said via social media, arrest me. Have you talked with him?
No, I haven't talked with him. I any second-year law student would be able to tell you that elected officials are indemnified from the votes that they take, and why the district attorney is deciding to weigh in on this issue after 25 years of not weighing into so many other issues that have affected our environment, a woman's right to choose, issues that are much more pressing. He has decided that he would provide an unsolicited letter to council members to tell them if they voted for this, they could face criminal charges. It's unprecedented, it's unheard of, and it's not worth my time discussing it with them.
Are you convinced that you and council have legislative immunity?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a basic declaration of the governance structure in this country. Whether it's on a local level, a state level, or a federal level, you don't arrest or file charges against elected officials for voting.
You were in Washington last week for the winter meeting of mayors. Gun violence was one of the topics of discussion. Do other mayors have the ability to act at the local level along with their city councils, or are they subject to their states as well?
So it really depends. In states like Florida, which have Republican governor, state legislature, and state senate, they have been under the same preemption law that Pennsylvania has, pretty much cookie cutter legislation, which also would hold elected officials liable. These types of laws have been manufactured by the gun manufacturing lobby and passed throughout red states throughout the country. So there is the interest in challenging them for cities and urban environments in the red states as well. Other states have the exact laws already on the books, which takes away the whole constitutional argument, because they are statewide provisions that ban these types of weapons or provide the ability to temporarily remove weapons from someone who's going to hurt themselves or hurt others. They're statewide in other states, so it's really a mixed bag.
Some might ask, why bother passing an ordinance that you cannot enforce currently under what state law is?
Because you got to do something. And if you don't believe that a law is just, the only way to be able to challenge it, well, there's two ways. The one way is to go through the legislative process, which I'm not sure that we have the votes in Harrisburg in order to be able to do, but we're going to try that as well. And the other is to go through the courts. And so we have to make a decision, either do nothing or challenge and say that this law is not just. Every change that has occurred in this country has started at a local level, whether it was the right for women to vote, whether it was the civil rights movement, whether it was the end of slavery, And I believe that gun reform will also start at the local level throughout this country, and then we'll finally be able to get it.
If council approves it and you sign it, will you try to enforce the restrictions that are proposed in this ordinance before the legislature acts, and even if they act and say no?
I haven't decided on that process yet. The process that I believe that will occur is that council will approve this, that I will sign it, and that some party that actually has standing will take us to court.
Challenging what you have signed.
Correct. That it will be a challenge over our ability to enact those laws.
Some years ago, earlier in your administration, the city backed off trying to enforce the straw purchase ordinance, which required gun owners to report lost or stolen guns within a certain time period. At the time, your administration indicated, well, it might not be able to afford to defend that law in a suit. It might be just too costly. So realistically, can you afford to do this?
First off, we have been approached by legal experts who have offered to defend the city pro bono. We're making that decision, but we have a law department that I rely on for a lot of different decisions. So regardless, it's not going to cost the taxpayers anything. We either use our in-house attorneys or we find pro bono assistance to be able to help us. We'll see which option. That hasn't been decided because we haven't been sued yet, but we have two options.
Could a suit involve more than just overturning a city ordinance? Damages, financial damages?
Well, that was under the lost and stolen handgun. The state legislature actually passed for the first time ever in Pennsylvania a provision in that would have held local governments to all the legal costs of both sides, win or lose. So if we went through the court systems in defending the city of Pittsburgh and won, we would still have to pay all of the legal fees of the NRA or the Gun Owners of America. That's unheard of. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous and also illegal. The bill that the state passed on lost and stolen handguns that the city of Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Lancaster challenged was thrown out for being unconstitutional. You have to realize that we've been playing defense on sensible gun reform for decades, really since the 1980s, and we've seen the proliferation of weapons that are designed to kill people the most efficient way possible, weapons that cause the most carnage and damage to the human body, those that the capacity to cause mass homicide, and we have to have sensible rules in place. You know, the seatbelt doesn't stop everyone from death by an automobile, but it saves lives. It's a common sense approach that is placed on a product in order to be able to make it safer. And if it saves one life, then it's worth having seatbelts. What we're saying is there are common sense rules with guns that, if applied, will save lives.
Do you expect the legislature to pass a change in state law, allowing municipalities the authority to adopt their own ordinances?
I don't realistically think that the legislature today will have the courage in order to be able to change the laws. But I do think that there will be a lot of suburban legislators who will see a different environment than what they've seen in the past, and a constituency within their own districts that support the laws, and they will have to defend why they won't.
So is this basically a political move, telling your supporters, hey, we're trying?
I wouldn't call it political. I would say that politics is definitely a part of the process. it's not being done simply for the optics of being able to say we're trying to do something. It's being done more so for the ability to challenge what we believe is an unjust law of preemption on the state level, that local cities should have the ability to do whatever they possibly can do to protect their people.
Final quick question on this. 6 months, 8 months, whatever the time frame, what do you expect the situation to be regarding the ordinance that is currently under consideration and what is in place in Harrisburg?
I believe that we will pass the legislation, potentially with amendments, during the first quarter of this year, and that then we will be in court later in this year defending the reasons why we feel it is necessary.
Do you expect challenges even if it's not enforced right off the bat, just the fact that it is passed?
It's been made very, very clear that there is no interest from the gun lobby to have anything discussed, let alone voted on at a local level, and that they will challenge anything in any way possible to make sure that local government never has a say about any issues involving guns.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, Bertha Lammy was the nation's first female mechanical engineer, and she wound up working at Westinghouse Electric. We'll take a look at her trailblazing career. And bitter cold temperatures are setting in for the next few days here in Pittsburgh. It's creating dangerous conditions for a population already in danger. Hear from a doctor who brings medicine directly to the homeless. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Shawnee chief Red Pole is buried in Trinity Cathedral on 6th Avenue downtown in 1797. The Native American leader was an ally of the white settlers living in the young city of Pittsburgh. He signed a peace treaty with President George Washington in Philadelphia the year before his death and was headed home to Ohio when he fell ill and died. He was buried with full military honors, and his gravestone reads, "Lamented by the United States." That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 1893, Bertha Lammy became the country's first female mechanical engineer. For 90.5 WESA's series on women in Pittsburgh history, Katie Blackley reports on how Lammy ended up at Westinghouse Electric.
In the early 1900s, one of the only ties women had to engineering would have been this.
The women of Westinghouse play an important part, too. The coils for motors are taped with the precision and perfection of feminine hands.
That's from a 1932 commercial for Westinghouse Electric, based in Pittsburgh. Engineering was an industry reserved for men, according to Society of Women Engineers archivist Troy Eller English. For women to even consider studying math or machines at a university, that was inconceivable.
Scholars at those institutions argued that if a woman attended their college, the woman's purity would be threatened, their reproductive and mental health would be irreparably harmed, and they would lose their femininity and their maternal instincts.
But in the Midwest, land-grant universities like Ohio State and Michigan State were more progressive and less likely to exclude women from entering traditional STEM fields. It was at Ohio State that Bertha Lammy earned her mechanical engineering degree.
With a specialty in a new and exciting field called electrical engineering.
There were no women's dormitories at OSU back then, so English says Lammy and a few other female students rented a house near campus. She would have often been the only woman in her classes. English said Lammy's accomplishments were noted by others on campus. Here's an excerpt from the student newspaper, The Lantern, about Lammy's graduation.
And one among those who stepped forth to receive this degree of mechanical engineering and electrical engineering was a sweet girl graduate, Miss Bertha Lamb. A spontaneous ripple of applause broke over the crowd.
Lammy had written her senior thesis about the Westinghouse Railway Generator, which caught the attention of the company. Lammy was hired a few months after her graduation in 1893, joining her brother Benjamin, who was a rising star at Westinghouse. Heinz History Center chief historian Ann Matteris says while at the company, Lammy would have been working on some of the bigger transportation systems projects. Her brother designed the giant generators at Niagara Falls.
So she's in a place where there's major innovation and change happening, new ideas that are going to impact the world. She would have had to be an excellent mathematician, conversant with calculations using a slide rule.
She stayed with Westinghouse for 12 years, and during her time there, Troy Eller English says her presence didn't go unnoticed.
You know, she wasn't rock star famous, but newspapers and women's journals, they did write about her career while she was working.
But as socially progressive as Westinghouse was at the time for employing a woman, it was still standard for ladies to retire when they married. So when Lammy wed a fellow engineer, she left the company. But historian Ann Matteris says Lammy encouraged her family to get involved in STEM fields. Her own daughter went on to become a physicist with the U.S. Bureau of Mines. Yet Matteris says even today, less than a quarter of all engineering degrees in the U.S. are awarded to women.
So while she was a trailblazer 120 years ago, there's still a ways to go to achieve equality within the field. But I think she is kind of a shining example of setting out on a path that few, if any, had trod before and succeeding.
The History Center does have a display dedicated to Bertha Lammy in its Westinghouse exhibit. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Frigid weather has hit much of the country, including the Pittsburgh region, forcing the closure of everything from schools and universities to the county courts to the Pittsburgh Zoo. This weather can be particularly dangerous for a vulnerable population. Joining us in studio are Dr. Jim Withers, founder, medical director of Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net, and Dan Palka, the group's street outreach director. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start off with both of you. What concerns you two the most about the impact of this very cold weather we're just seeing?
Well, I mean, obviously the risk of people losing fingers, toes, or freezing to death. There was a fellow that froze, was it last mm-hmm. couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
Here in Pittsburgh, who was outdoors. And so it's a real risk, especially if people aren't quite prepared for this sudden drop like this.
Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, just that and chronic health conditions, people living outside, they are exacerbated by the cold always.
Right. Yeah. And you two see it close. You witness the horrible impact that this weather can have.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
There is winter emergency shelter that opened, I believe, in November. Warming centers at various senior centers in the area. Are there enough facilities? Is there enough space to get people in from out of this terrible cold?
I think we're in Pittsburgh, we're fortunate to have close to enough. We could certainly use more bed space of all kinds. But oftentimes there are difficulties with people being willing to accept programs that they're not familiar with. And navigating it can be difficult. That's why our teams really sometimes have to really dig in and make sure that we get all the paperwork done and the patient person qualified to get in. When it gets really cold like this, I'm always surprised, though, that how many people there are that we didn't know about that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these temperatures will force people out of the woodwork oftentimes. And, for example, tonight I anticipate that the severe weather emergency shelter at 620 Smithfield will be over capacity for sure.
Jim, you said enough beds. Are you talking about emergency overnight shelters? Are you talking about shelters that people can reside there for certain periods of time, or what specifically?
The whole spectrum. But I mean, clearly with this weather, you're talking about what are you going to do tonight? Emergency shelters. The regular shelters, I know, expand the number of beds that they have, which is a great help. But there's always, you know, at least maybe 200 or so people that were in the depth of winter that just don't seem to be able to get in or can't or won't go anywhere else.
I want to expand on something that you said, and you say get people to accept. Are we talking about homeless people to accept coming in, accept this, to know about these opportunities? Are we just talking about general public acceptance of the needs of the homeless?
Well, I was specifically kind of referring to the perspective of someone who has had trauma basically associated with navigating our social service system, feeling rejected, having been mistreated sometimes. And sometimes that's their perception, perhaps more from our point of view, but it's real for them. And I know some would rather die than go to a standard shelter.
Dan, as the organization's straight outreach director, do you encounter this, and what do you hear from individuals when you're trying to make them aware of at least some temporary opportunities for them to get at least a little comfort?
So we have a huge subset of our population that are fully aware of the resources that exist, because of the trauma that Dr. Withers mentioned, they are not as willing to engage. And so typically what we do is we just meet people where they are outside and try to leave the door open, as we always say, and just allow them to come in whenever they want and let them know that the resources are always there if they need them. But oftentimes, maybe tonight is a perfect example of a time when individuals who are previously very recalcitrant about engaging might, because of the degree of cold, step in, engage, utilize services even episodically, and then they might just go back outside again.
Mm-hmm. How much is it about building trust? You just don't show up once,
right,
and it's like then you're gone.
Right. I think the work that we do all summer allows us to have folks feel comfortable with coming in to our winter shelter in the winter. So it's the groundwork that you lay with a year-round relationship that's most important.
Dan, how do you build that one-on-one relationship?
Just being present often. It's about not forcing an agenda on any single person and making sure that people know that you are first and foremost listening before sort of telling them what you think they should do or what you think is best for them. Often people have a strong idea of what that is. And when you come in and you sort of paternalistically project what your ideas are for their life, they don't receive it very well. So going in and making sure that you hear what their wishes are for their life goes a really, really long way.
So you're not trying to dictate, you're listening.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's important to know that a lot of the folks that are out there have mental health issues.
Right.
And they're everything from depression to, schizophrenia and bipolar disease and things like that. And they look like they should be employable. They look like they should be, doing well physically. But a lot of them have had terrible trauma. And so there are deep issues that take a long time to gain the trust of folks.
And so not only do you deal with the physical health, you're trying to deal with those mental health challenges. Tell us a little bit about the Wellspring Drop-In Center that Operation Safety Net operates.
Right. It's got a wonderful long history. It was started before I started my work, I believe, by a group of mental health consumers that put it together as a sort of a social justice place for themselves. And then later on, Pittsburgh Mercy helped them when their economics weren't stable. And it's been kind of a club. People come in, they have to have a membership, but it allows people to come in and engage services, get into recovery. There are lockers there. We have art therapy. We have a medical clinic there. And it's been a great platform over the years to engage people at a, you know, a kind of a low barrier level, whereas some other places that do good work have higher barriers for expectations for people. We find that if we can meet people in a setting like that, as Dan described, that it really does help them get into the things that they need.
Right. But they have to make the voluntary decision to seek this out. You can make them aware of this center, but they have to make the decision, I'm going to drop in, if you want. So, Dan, I wanted to follow up then. With mental health issues, how does that also maybe complicate that building of trust to make people aware of what is there for them?
Yeah, it's it can be very, very complicated. Oftentimes, outreach is working in conjunction with other providers at Pittsburgh Mercy to try to create a sort of coordinated team to respond to some of the issues that these people on the street have. But initially, it's being very creative. It's, again, listening more than talking and trying to create a sort of presence that people feel welcome in, so that you can be the first step to help them sort of set foot through the door and start engaging with some of the services that they need.
For about a decade or so, organizations including Operation Safety Net, Light of Life Ministry, have been partnering with the Allegheny County Department of Human Services to conduct a point-in-time survey of homeless in the area. It's happening now. In a sense, how reliable is this information, and what can you do with it? How does it help you gentlemen, you know, sort of provide the services, meet the needs that are out there?
Yeah, so the point in time is actually occurring today, and it's done once a year. This is an initiative by HUD to try to gain a sort of picture, like a snapshot of how many people are on the street. It's not perfect by any means. We send out groups with team leaders who are basically community representatives with a handful of other volunteers to sort of canvass the streets and ask anyone that they encounter, do you know anyone who's experiencing homelessness? On a night like tonight, for example, with the temperatures being what they are, we don't anticipate the highest turnouts because obviously we're not going to be encountering too many people on the street.
Because a lot of those might have taken advantage of the emergency shelter?
Correct. And also they'll double up, so they'll stay with a relative, even if just for the night, but then they may go back out on the street the following day or whenever the temperatures sort of start to rise. There are abandoned buildings in a lot of the communities that people will seek shelter in as well that are very difficult to keep tabs on. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the emergency provisions that are in place for them.
So is there, and of course, one January to another, I don't know how cold it was 12 months ago on this particular date, but just how cold it is can skew those numbers as well?
That's right.
Jim?
And, you know, they do count people that go into the shelters, and the shelters are part of this as a definition of homelessness. But it does definitely affect who is perceived to be unsheltered.
Right. Okay. And so therefore, do you try to come up with maybe a more accurate number at a time where the weather might not be such a factor?
All right. So we've started in July to do another count ourselves, totally mirroring what we do in January. And we get different numbers, but it sort of reflects different subsets of the homeless population. So, for example, in July, we'll have more sort of transient travelers, people who come in on trains and other things, and it'll kind of tip the scales in one direction, whereas in the winter, they wouldn't have been around.
Well, Jim, I want to take you back about 27 years. The concept of Operation Safety Net actually started in 1992 with you making house calls, so to speak, to people living on the street. What were you trying to accomplish then?
Well, I had, you know, concerns about some of the patients I saw. One gentleman in particular left the hospital despite our best intentions to keep him there. And He froze to death, and that made an impact on me. But to be honest, I was really quite concerned with the humanism of doctors and health people. We tend to have trouble understanding what the reality of what people are going through. I worked with domestic violence as an issue in the late 80s, and it really sharpened my thinking that you have to kind of understand what a person's living through, not just what their list of diagnoses are, to really see where that person's healing could come. And so I wanted a classroom in which we were forced to see what someone else's reality was. Mm-hmm. You can get that from overseas work, and I love that, but I felt right here in Pittsburgh we need to be more accountable for bringing services to people with some humility, with some openness to understanding what their real circumstances are. And you don't get that in a busy ER or a clinic or a hospital so much, because people literally have to kind of follow our rules. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to flip the script, and I wanted this to be part of medical education, which in fact in over 25 medical schools now they have street medicine as part of their curriculum. So it's come a long way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an important element of rehumanizing healthcare is to get out where people are and like Dan said, don't necessarily have all the agendas for them, but partner with them in solidarity to create their own healing.
Right. We have just a couple of minutes left. And Operation Safety Net has grown in reaching out with additional services, Dan. It's mm-hmm. You have a whole list of what you're doing.
Yeah. We have now we have a mobile medical unit, which will go around the entire city to various communities. And there are two sort of doctor's offices on this medical unit. We have Wellspring, as we mentioned, the Winter Shelter, which is open 4 months of the year. And then we provide housing and case management. So it's expanded beyond just the street medicine model. And now it's moved into the sort of next level in the spectrum, which is trying to get these people housed. And then, of course, we do legal assistance, and we provide all sorts of referrals for other services within Mercy and outside of the organization. Right. Yeah.
Jim, I wanted to ask you, what are the challenges to helping clients get their own places?
Wow. Increasingly around the country, it's a lack of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. I think that there are people have barriers from their past that have to be navigated, debts and criminal records and things like that that are difficult. But I think a lot of times it's just finding a good match for the individual that they can accept and landlords that would be willing to work with a population that's more at risk.
And have you seen success in this area about people being able to maintain that housing once they get it?
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't always perfect, just like the liver transplants or something. But it's so gratifying to go make a home visit now with someone who I knew from under a bridge. There was a guy at a bank a couple years ago, and he was a security guard, and he said, "Hello, doctor." And I said, "Oh, do I know you?" And he said, "Yes, I was under a bridge in the 90s, and you people helped me." So that to me is really satisfying to know that people reclaim their own lives. And we've had well over 2,000 people that we've placed in apartments and other types of housing.
Dr. Jim Withers is founder, medical director of Pittsburgh Mercy's Operation Safety Net. Dan Palka is the street outreach director for Operation Safety Net. Thanks, gentlemen, for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we visit with actor-writer Dan Ruth on funneling his own alcoholism and adversity in the service industry into a solo comedy and the increased efforts to legalize recreational marijuana in Pennsylvania. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.